Blog Talk Radio. And welcome to another edition of Continue Mission. I am your host, James McCormick. And tonight, as you can see, we're going to discuss the end of the war in Afghanistan. We'll have a little dialogue on that. But what we really want to focus on is how are we going to positively assist the veterans of this war, the people that have carried the burden, have borne the battle for over almost 20 years. It's a long time. Entire military career at war. Think about that. You think about that. Their entire military career was at war. So I, being a veteran of this war, and many others who've been veterans of these wars, you know, whether it be OIF or OEF, you know, we've seen a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, a lot of anguish. You know, there's been people that have been injured and killed and a lot of injuries. You know, if you go look at the, you know, the wounds and stuff, you know, you're looking at 50-some thousand people, you know, that have been wounded. I have to look at some of the exact figures, probably higher than that. You're probably looking more like in the numbers of hundreds of thousands who have become disabled. You know, maybe they weren't wounded in combat, but they were injured by the constant back and forth, back and forth. It has a wear and tear on your body. You're beating around. You're carrying around great, great equipment. I would not be sitting here today had I not been wearing my vest, my ballistic vest. You know, I was shot right over the heart. The bullet lodged in my sappy plate, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And I can tell you that I wouldn't be here if it had not been for that equipment. If I'd have been wearing a different vest, maybe the vest that I wore when I was in Desert Storm, or the vest that the soldiers wore when they were in Vietnam, that bullet would have probably went in one end and right out the other. Might have slowed it down a little bit, but it definitely wouldn't have stopped it. Battlefield medicine's another thing, too, that really saved a lot of lives, prevented, you know, injuries that were catastrophic to become injuries that there was no hope for. You know, in some wars, in particular, in this war, we had a trademark injury known as traumatic brain injury, blast-related injury. It is. It's the trademark of this war. Why? Because the enemy employed tactics of insurgency and booby traps, and I can tell you that it created a lot of people. Never got a Purple Heart, but probably deserve it. The problem is that, you know, a lot of people think that all traumatic brain injuries are eligible for the Purple Heart. But mild MTBI, which is the majority, they call it a mild case of traumatic brain injury, which I've seen MTBIs that have rendered people nearly speechless, with an inability to function, with an inability to remember things. That went there perfectly healthy young men and young women, and they come back and they don't recognize people that they've known their whole life. You know, maybe some doctor, maybe somebody will say, well, that's an MTBI. But I can tell you that's life-altering for that troop that's dealing with that. So I wrote a letter this week watching the collapse of the Afghanistan government. Notice how I said that. It's not the collapse of the U.S. government. It was the collapse of the Afghanistan government, who was handed a gift-wrapped package. And people will argue with me on this. They'll say, but we didn't prepare them. They had 20 flipping years. Do you understand that my kids left the house when they were 18, so we gave them 2 more years than what we generally give our children? And is it really their fault either? No. It is the culture. It is the culture that is there. It's the tribalism. The same thing happened in Iraq. We didn't see the big blow up like we see now. Maybe it's because you had different presidents in the office. I don't know. But I know ISIS ran a juggernaut through there, and it was looking bad. You know, fortunately, you know, they were able to regain and you know, take a lot of that territory back and put ISIS on their heels or their knees, whatever you want to call it. But the point that I make is Afghanistan and Iraq are two different countries. Two different countries, two whole different scenarios. You know, we have an obligation to our allies that are over there. We really have the most of our obligation is to the veterans and the families that fought this war. There are kids, literally, that are 18 years old now. And have their dads and moms have been gone 13 to 14 out of the 18 years of their life. And they went back and forth and back. And a lot of people gripe and complain about one tour. Imagine doing 2, 3, 4, 6, 10, 13. That happened. And they weren't just 30, 60, 90-day tours. We're talking 6 months to a year. Both of my sons went over there. They both were gone a year. And I worried about them every day. And that's just the reality of it, join me. It made me a bitter man. You know, imagine you sending your sons or your daughters to fight in a war that you fought in when they were just little babies. That's a fact. This war has created generational veterans. So that's why it's important for us, number one, to tell the dang truth about what the soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Guardians did over there. They kicked the dog crap, Taliban, the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, anybody that we faced. We never lost a battle. We never lost the war either. A lot of people say, well, you won the battles, but you lost the war. They said the same thing about Vietnam, failing to recognize that there was a peace treaty because the North Vietnamese begged us to the table. I don't care what anybody says. You might have not liked Richard Nixon, but probably the best thing he did was Operation Linebacker whenever he put the hammer down and bombed the crap out of the North Vietnamese and made them howl, howl, beg, please stop. We can't make people honor their commitments. Some people say, well, why don't we just go back in and do this and do that? Okay, you'll go back in. We'll kill a bunch of them. We've done that. Killed bin Laden, killed a bunch of his friends and families. Man, I'm telling you, we put funeral homes in business, baby, over there. Ultimately, they hide in a cave, like most cowards do, and then they come out whenever the stronger person, you know, leaves. It's no different than being in a boxing ring and knocking somebody out, and then they raise your hand up and they say, you know, the winner is, and then the lights go out and everybody leaves. That guy's laying there on the ground. He gets up and he stands up and he turns the light on and says, no, I won. No, you didn't. You got knocked out. Okay? You didn't win. And our soldiers need to hear that. They don't need to hear this constant back and forth. We lost it all. It was for nothing. I don't know about you guys, but I fought for my friends on my left and my right flank and for the soldiers that I was responsible to lead. It didn't matter to me. I wasn't in there for the politics. I was in there to complete the mission, and you can ask my commanders. I completed every mission. Our soldiers completed every mission. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. Now, some people will have you be ashamed because, you know, it's a political thing. We got to blame it on the president. If the other president was in there, you know, now we didn't hear the same howling, you know, whenever Iraq was looking like it was going to fall. People are like, did that really happen? Yeah, it really happened. Go look it up. Look up ISIS. People were murdered, drug out in the streets. They were shot. You name it. It all happened. That's why our troops were in Syria. That's why we had to do Spartan Shield. Okay? And that's just the truth. So we're not facing anything different today other than a different political climate and louder people running their mouth. The majority of them have never served one flipping day in uniform. They have no concept of what warfare is like other than what they see from, you know, from their reporting of it. And there's a big difference standing up being a bystander. You know, it's like the difference between a football player and the water boy, okay? There's a big difference between the two. So, you know, I've made it a point that I will correct people and I will be nice as I can to people, but ultimately, don't come and tell me about losing anything. And then don't be griping because, oh, it's going to cost $2.6 trillion to help all these veterans. Where are we going to get the money? Well, where in the hell did we get the $6.5 trillion to fight this war? Go get it and help these veterans and their families and these Gold Star families with the same veracity as you wanted to pump money into going to war. That's all we're asking. Be fair. Look, if you put $6.9 million, you can at least put $6.9 trillion. You can at least put $3.5 trillion into helping the vets and the families that served in this war. I'm of the belief you should pay equal amount that you put into the war into those that fought it. Now, so I'm telling you, there'll be pushback. I promise you there'll be pushback. There'll be a lot of people when I make a speech like that, they'll be like clapping their hands and saying, oh, hallelujah, he's saying the great things. But when they come to the point of actually writing the checks, we ain't got the money. Where'd you get the money before? Less than 10% of the population fought that war. I'm going to say it's even less than that. If the rest of us can't pony up the money, then there's something wrong with us. Okay? That's my opinion. That's just my opinion. And some people won't like it. But we need to do things that are going to help the veterans. So I don't want to drag it. I don't want to belabor it anymore. We had a lot of music and a lot of things, so it's normally, you know, we get started, you know, within 15 minutes. So we went a little bit longer than that tonight because, you know, I wanted to play, you know, a tribute, a farewell to arms, the music is a tribute to those who fought this war. Yes, I'm one of them, but I was there and back a long time ago. But like my sons, like your sons, your daughters, the people that didn't come home, that's who this is for. Their families. You know, we as a veterans organization, I'm a national commander of a very prestigious, extremely large veterans organization here in the United States. And I'm telling you, every day we're talking about how we can take care of our veterans and their families. And woe be us if we have a child of a service member that gave his or her life in defense of this nation, I don't care where it's at, but gave his or her life serving in the military, and we can't afford to send them to school to make sure that they're taken care of. May we never come to that day, or we never get so small and petty that we argue over who's in the White House. What political party's running it? I don't give a good gosh darn. We've got to take care of these people when they come home. You know, my mission when I was at war was to engage and destroy the enemy by the use of fire and maneuver, to protect and secure convoys and routes of transport all along the Iraqi theater of operation. put a lot of emphasis in that. A lot of my heart went into that. And the same emphasis and heart is going to go into this new mission of now ensuring that our veterans and their families are never forgotten, and that we fight at every place we can on Capitol Hill. It's a different fight now, guys and gals. So don't think that I'm talking about going to arms. I'm talking about doing what we do diplomatically now. So now we're in a different position. But give that same energy and effort to ensuring that those politicians, that a lot of them right now, you know, are sitting around and you know, complaining about the money or complaining about taking care of the interpreters or our allies that are being left over there to be slaughtered, that's wrong too. You know, and we've made that very clear. Our organization has. We have signed on to that agreement that we should not leave them. And to do so is a violation of our code of conduct, in my opinion, and our honor code. It is. When I was in Operation Desert Storm, and I can remember this very well, I was just a Sergeant E5. I didn't have much say in what went on. But when I found out about what the Iraqi army did to the Kurds and the Shias in the south, murdered them by scores after we left, these people that helped us, you know, kick Saddam out of Kuwait, decimate the world's fourth largest army, the world's fourth largest army at the time. They went from the fourth largest army in the world to the fourth largest army in Iraq by the time we were done with them. But then we left. And then the war struck up. I don't want to see that happen. For 30 years, I've sat around and thought about that. You know, it's weighed on my conscience. Because at the time, I didn't have, the only thing that gave me any peace was the fact that I was a sergeant. I couldn't do much. What could I really do to change that? But now I'm in a whole lot different position. And now this voice is amplified through over 50,000 members, this organization, every one of them sacrificing for this nation. And we are saying, let's uphold our commitment to our allies and don't just leave them. That's been the past practice. So we do have that obligation and to take care of our veterans. So we're going to bring on Father Michael. We're going to bring on Rich Kilblain. Let me see if I can get you on there, Rich. It just keeps going around and around. Okay. And then I believe we're going to have a guest speaker as well. So let me see here. Give me just 1 second. How's it going, Rich?
Going pretty good. I'm not as busy as you are. I'm enjoying my retirement. Yeah. So you're retired too, aren't you? Supposedly.
Yeah, I am retired. Yeah, I did retire.
Yeah. What they call semi-retired?
Semi-retired. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in other words, you're working more than you did when you were working full time. Oh,
feels
but you're
like
not getting
I'm,
paid for it. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I do run a museum, and I get paid for that.
True.
So that's a
true.
Lot of fun.
Yeah. That is.
So right now, I feel like I'm herding cats. Have you ever heard the term?
Oh
herding
man, that's.
Cats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see that. Okay, so the Colonel's not going to be able to come on tonight, which is okay.
Too bad.
Yeah. Too bad.
Oh.
So you heard, you know, what I'm saying in the beginning. You know, there was a document that went out today, and there was only two veterans organizations that were what they consider congressionally chartered that signed on to this. Ours was one of them. And it was a very serious letter to our commander-in-chief, you know, asking them, essentially, don't leave our allies to be slaughtered. Now, with that being said, and you know, with me exercising you know, my ability to, you know, to not step outside of my lane, but just operating now as a radio host, I would tell you that, you know, my personal feeling on this is that there are three things that we have to do. Number one is we have to stop perpetuating the lie that we somehow, we as in the Warriors, the warfighters, lost this. You got to stop perpetuating that. The media's got to stop. They got to stop talking like that. The defeatist attitude. They got to stop because they're lying when
they
say that.
I can address that. I wrote something for my classmates to explain what was going on because for the class of West Point class of 79. We have an email. I don't know what you would call it. It's not a blog, but we're all connected. And so we've had this discussion. And the thing I pointed out is that since the Spanish-American War, Americans have been shedding blood for the liberty and freedom of other people around the world. Mm-hmm. Now, what they do with that liberty and freedom is not on us. We give it to them. It's not what they do. If they lose it, that's not our fault. We've secured it for them, and we give it to them. Now here, and you've addressed this, and we have never been driven from a, well, except for like World War II or whatever, never been driven from a battlefield. Okay? Mm-hmm. Our army has not lost wars. Okay.
That's correct.
So we can't be judged on what people do after we give them their liberty and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in most cases, the decision to pull out is a political decision. Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. You use the analogy of a boxer, after he's knocked the person out and walked away. No. The enemy has not been knocked out. He's still fighting. That is an analogy of we've got him on the ropes and we're beating the crap out of him, and then our trainer, our coach, decides to throw the towel in because he's tired of watching the fight. He wants to go home. That's how I see it, okay? Biden threw in the towel. Trump threw in the towel, okay? Both are to blame on this. All right, but I want to address sons and daughters, sending sons and daughters off to war. Nobody sends sons and daughters. Did you send your son to Afghanistan? Did you send your son to Afghanistan?
I didn't send, not personally, no, but I was there when they got on the plane.
Your son was trying to follow in your footsteps. He volunteered.
Yeah.
And he went to Afghanistan, and the army sent him to Afghanistan. This guy and your son enlisted during the time of war.
Yeah,
did your father send you to Iraq? Two times.
No.
He's a Vietnam vet. Did he send you to Iraq two times? No. You volunteered, and you went two times. Okay? Look, when you talk about a 20-year war, look, I was in the third grade when the Vietnam War started, and I remember, because I come from a family of traditional military service, which is what most veterans are. We represent less than 7% of the American population. At any one time, less than 1% is serving in the military. We are a small percentage of the Americans. Yeah, you can sit there and go, yeah, the majority of Americans, you know, they want to get out of Afghanistan. Yeah, but you're not fighting in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small percentage of this nation that wants to go to war. Okay, we don't care what war it is. We're looking for the war. You know, when I was in the third grade, I remember when the Vietnam War started, I'm like, I wonder if there'll be a war like this when I grew up. Because you got to understand, this town I grew up in Oklahoma, everybody was a veteran. I think the entire class in 1950 served in Korea. Okay? Everybody I knew was a vet. I just thought that was normal. You grew up, you graduated high school, you went off to fight the war, and then you came back. Okay? And sure enough, in 1973, that same, I'm a senior in high school, actually 72 is when I entered my senior year. I'm like, this war's going on. I might actually get to go. And sure enough, when I, a month after I went to a recruiter, delayed enlistment, you know, 6 month enlistment, Nixon signed the peace treaty. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's interesting because we still had stay behind forces in Vietnam up until 75. And I got to Okinawa, the first special forces group on 73. And my unit still had people over there. Okay. As soon as I got picked up for the academy, I should have hounded the sergeant major and say, hey, look, I need some more experience than sitting around Okinawa. You know, I did get to do one mission in Korea. I said, is there a slot in Vietnam I can go and see real world missions? But no, I grew up wanting to go to war. And I have a nephew who was looking forward to going to Afghanistan. So when these politicians get up there and start citing sending sons and daughters, no one sends sons. No parent wants to send their son. Did you want to – you talked to – how did you feel when your son went off to war?
Well, you know how I felt because you and I talked about it a lot because, you know, we're good friends. But I'm going to tell you.
Yeah.
It was a miserable feeling. And I was in the.
Right.
And I want to tell you, I just wanted to say this real quick. When I was sitting in the bedroom with my 12-year-old son, and he asked me, you know, because he knows that I've went to war and he knows that his two brothers, he remembers that very well, you know, because, you know, it was just not too long ago. And he says, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan? And him and I were talking. And when I looked at him, it really dawned on me at that time when I said, I hope that there is no war when you get old enough to go, you know. And he just looked at me.
As parents, that's how we feel. And so when politicians get up there and keep using this term, sons and daughters, they're tugging at the heartstrings.
Yeah.
You know, you and I wanted to go to war. I've been to war, okay? I would have done it, okay? But we don't want to, it's like, but when it comes to our kids, no. You know, I'm sitting there like, you know, well, my son didn't have an interest in serving, but I got a grandson, okay? And he didn't grow up like that. And I'm going, man, you hate to lose them. At least back, and there was a time when we had, when we grew up, you know, there was like the nuclear family was, there was four kids. So like if you lose one, you still got three more. It's less than two. Okay. So
unless you're in the McCormick house,
most families only have one child. You lose that child, that's the end of your bloodline. Okay.
Yeah.
So the risk is even greater. Okay, the family name comes in unless you've got brothers who are carrying it on. Okay, but as I said last week, we have enough people wanting to volunteer to go to war. We could keep a brigade in Afghanistan. I'm sorry about your mothers and fathers, but guess what? You raised your kids well, or whatever happened, you know, your kids. Less than 7% of this nation, or 1% at any given time, they are the ones who are willing to step up. And keep in mind, the sad part of it is less than 30% of American youth don't even qualify to serve. So those people going downrange that are getting hurt, they're the best this nation has to offer. That's the sad part about it. So anyway, that's my take about this 20-year war and stuff. But I've been listening to the press. I've been listening.
Yeah.
I listened to. I didn't listen to Biden's interview with George Stephanopoulos the other night, but I listened to his press brief on Monday when he walked. You know, which he just said what he said and walked away. You know, he took the. You know, he said the buck stops with him, but he blamed everybody else but him, And then, but I listened to I watched his speech today, his press brief today, and what I really got interested in is how the media reacted to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you right now, folks, Biden's honeymoon with the mainstream media is over. They were starting with Sunday. I mean, come on, guys. If you were watching the news on Sunday, you were watching history unfold. What, the Taliban, you know, entered the capital city. The president of Afghanistan. Oh, first, and then the State Department abandons the embassy, lowers the flag. The president of Afghanistan flees the country, and Kabul falls. I mean, that's significant. And then what we've seen unfold over the week is, you know, a repeat of Saigon, 1975. I mean, we're seeing history in the making. But but seriously, the media has been slamming him. Now,
so here,
here's
what
a lot
I will,
we can. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
But what I'm looking at, Rich, and then I want to get Father Michael's insight on this, but a little bit too. But this, how is it? You know, everybody's talking about the Taliban and this and stuff. Look, if they really wanted, they can't take the airport. You know, they can't. Not because they won't. Because they can't, and they know that they can't.
Right,
they can operate outside
there.
They know darn good and well what'll happen. The troops that are there will slaughter them by the scores. So, you know, as an American looking at that, I'm like, you know, I really don't see the chaos, the gates flying open. You know, of course, it was a lot different with the fall of Saigon. And I'm just looking at this. The South Vietnamese Army was the prime defender there. It wasn't the U.S. troops. We had a few Marines in the embassy, correct? That was essentially what we had whenever, we had to abandon the embassy. And we've abandoned embassies in Libya. We've abandoned embassies in other countries as well, Eastern Bloc countries. And that's been something that is not abnormal. Historically, I think that what you see is you see, I'm trying to think of how the media puts it. They really try to gin this thing up to make it look like something that it's not, or make it sound like, oh, my God, this has never happened before. Well, then they don't understand history. Then. What's your thoughts on that as a historian?
Well, I tended to see the parallels with Saigon. No, I know we have closed embassies around the country, but not where we are. We are running away, literally running away. We are evacuating. The difference, though, between Saigon 1975 and today is that the embassy ran to the airport and set up operations there, and we have until the end of the month to get everybody out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference. But what you have is, see, there are parallels with the boat people crisis, okay, where you've got all these Vietnamese who are worried about being punished, put in education camps and things like that. And they were fleeing with whatever boat or helicopter they could get. And similarly, you know, they weren't going straight to the United States. They were going to intermediate areas like the Philippines, the holding areas where they would be processed. And that's exactly what's happening now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to point out, though, before we bring Father Pacello on, Michael on, is in listening to his speech, Biden's press briefing today, all right, the media, and I'm not talking Fox. I mean, it's like now I enjoy watching CNN because CNN is now honest. They're being fair now. And ABC, that's what I was watching today. ABC and
more. Yeah, the hell yeah, they're being unfair. Yeah,
no, I know. But anyway, so they're all so we're talking mainstream media is pointing out all the fact checking, everything that was wrong in his speech.
Good.
Okay, the question is he outright lying, or is he that clueless? All right, but here's the thing: I'm going to tell you. I'm going to take the reverse side. That there were two things he said that was correct. One, it's a very dangerous situation. We have sent our soldiers into a very dangerous situation. Yes. Okay. And the other thing is the outcome is probably going to be unpredictable, which is weird because he just said, anybody who wants out of, any American or any of the SIVs, the special immigration visas, those who have worked for any of you guys that want to get out of the country, you'll be able to get out. But he goes on to say, we don't really know how this thing's going to turn out. And here's what I'm going to say. As I'm sitting there playing it over and I'm listening to what everybody has to say, and I'll render the floor to you and Father Michael after this, I'm going to say, so as I'm hearing him say, anybody that wants to get out of the country can get out, I'm hearing Trump going, anybody that wants a vaccination can get a vaccination. He's trying to put the most optimistic spin on it. He's trying. I agree with him. He's like, he's not going to admit he screwed up. He's going to defend his decision, but he's not going to admit he screwed up because everybody's saying, like, this shouldn't happen this way. So he says, okay, but this is what we're going to do. And he did a great job except for, his facts were wrong. But the thing is, I don't think he's instilling confidence, okay? He's like Trump trying to tell you, guys, don't worry about COVID. We're all going to get through this. We're all going to get through this. Biden is reading from the Trump playbook, even though he doesn't know he's doing it. Okay, so that's my 2 cents or 5 cents or 10 cents, whatever.
About $1.75 there.
we're gonna count that up in places.
Yeah, that's right. Father Michael, U.S. Army chaplain, been around. He was in the U.S. Navy during Vietnam as a sailor, and been around the horn. Got a son that served over in Afghanistan. So what's your thoughts on all this? And then, how do we fix it?
I would certainly like to go back to your concerns about how we receive the veterans. Even though I was on a ship, part of a task force, I did have an opportunity to go into Da Nang, but we weren't able to work that. There was a lot of action, a lot of things that you mentioned that President Nixon did. I was a part of 71 and 72. But I'm concerned when I went to college, the way I was treated, I'm concerned the way the American people are going to treat our heroes when they come home, when they're identified as being veterans of the Afghanistan war. Because, people didn't know what you did. You're a baby killer, this and that. The country was in a different place. But I'm really concerned about what you're saying also about the benefits. The World War II veterans came home as heroes to parades, all these different benefits that we've all been able to dip into. But I'm really concerned about the resources and things of that nature and how they'll be received. Our country can be very, very mean. There are times that I'll have people come up to me if I'm wearing a Vietnam veteran hat, and welcome home, this and that. But during the time, it was so antagonistic. And sometimes it almost doesn't matter after you've had that much rejection. We've had 100,000 suicides of Vietnam veterans for many, many reasons. But one of them was the way we were received back. And so I'm very concerned on how the country celebrates these great heroes that put in all this time and all this blood and forget about the treasure. They're the treasure. You know, you said about we didn't send our sons. You know, my grandfather was in the Army. My father was, my son, myself. And I remember talking to my son who was in 3rd Infantry Division just before he left. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I cried like a baby, but I had no regrets because I had spent time with him. I prepared him ethically, morally. I loved him. And because he had a top secret clearance as an E4, I was able to communicate with him. And but you're always proud. But like you said, every day you're concerned, are they going to get killed? I mean, this is real. And I remember one of my relatives, we told them that my son went over to Afghanistan, and she said, did he bring his wife? Like, these are people who have nothing to do with the military, and they didn't realize how much he risked his life and all that he'd been through. You know, he'll share with me as we talk about different things, little things that I didn't know that took place and that happened. So I'm really concerned in the way the country receives our veterans, the way the Veterans Administration handles things, and the way the budget, you know, we talk so much, even when you go to different organizations, you know, for insurance, and they're always, oh, thank you for your service, we appreciate it. But then when they have to help you, they sometimes drop the ball. And I get tired of hearing that. You know, thank you for your service, and we're here to serve you. You served us. But then doesn't always come. So I'm real concerned about that, as you stated in the beginning, how we're going to really take care of them. And as you mentioned, there are different types of issues that they're dealing with. And I still work with cadets. I still work with soldiers. And so I'm very concerned about that. You know, it's interesting because I served in Korea, and, you know, that was 69 years ago. And certainly we're still in Germany, where I believe Rich, and I don't know if you served there, but that was 76 years ago. And for some reason, I was listening to General Jack Keane, who was my commanding general when I was at Fort Bragg, 97 through 2000. And I'm concerned about holding the line. You know, I'm concerned. I did a lot of research, a lot of reading, a lot of listening. I even listened to a reporter from Kabul who was an Afghani. And or Afghanistan citizen, and you know, some of the uncertainties, the distrust of the Taliban keeping their word and things of that nature. And one of the things I kept hearing is, you know, you can take over and make promises just like a lot of politicians, but can you govern? Can they really govern, you know, and serve people, take care of people? So there's a lot of concerns there. And even Rich was talking about the boat people. You know, I've met some Vietnamese since I've been here. You know, refugees. You know, we have such an open border, and we're so concerned about those in South America. But is that same compassion for our comrades who served with us, worked with us, is that still going to be something that we're going to open our arms to, the huddled masses? So I'm concerned there as well. I know that the Russians spent 10 years. We spent 20 years, did everything we could, and it's like they dropped the ball. You know, they you know, the training. I have another colonel friend that was my Ranger buddy when I was at Fort Bragg. He was just a first lieutenant then. But they did a lot of training, and it just seems like everybody's saying, you know, it didn't take because of our inadequacy or our deficiency. And I just appreciate the way you spoke about what a wonderful and great job our soldiers did in training the Afghanis.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, and that's the big message. And we, because there are a lot of us out there, you know, we need to go shoulder to shoulder with our fellow veterans. It doesn't matter what war you served in or whatever, but just, you know, the first thing we need to do is say, number one, we refuse for you to distort the historical facts. So, and when they do, that's why in the organization I'm with, we have an Americanism program that actually teaches real no-joke history that will tell people about, you know, what Richard Nixon did to bring the North Vietnamese to their knees. You know, that's written at least 1,000 times in different journals, books that talk about that. And the North Vietnamese will admit to that, that, you know, if it would have kept up for a matter of days, that they would have totally just collapsed. But, you know, they wanted peace.
I was a part of the mining of Haiphong Harbor in North Vietnam.
Okay.
And so we were doing all kinds of different things. You know, as they were pulling troops out, our planes were bombing, you know, obliterating in a lot of ways.
Ripping them up.
So, that's right.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate it, you know, that perspective, because that's really what brought an end, so to speak, as you stated.
And that was the time when, you know, even the prisoners, John McCain talked about a time when the guards started treating them differently because they knew the end was near and that they would have to answer for what they did. So they started getting fed. They started getting treated better. You know, there was a, you know, please tell them that we've treated you decent, you know, and there were apologies that were made. And ask the prisoners that were there. There's many of them that wrote about it. I'm trying to think about the other. There was two or three of the others. But it's interesting when you really dig
into this. Admiral Stockdale maybe too?
Yes, Admiral Stockdale, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
His book will, you know, where he talks about that. So in Afghanistan, you know, there are a lot of similarities, but we had the same thing in Iraq. You know, we handed it over. We trained the troops up. You know, we worked with the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police. You know, we've done everything that we can do. Now, ultimately, when 9/11 occurred, there was a very distinct mission: punish those who attacked our country. And we did that. We actually did that within the first 3 years. We horrifically punished them. So, you know, by 2005, 2006, you know, 4 or 5 years, 2007, I mean, we had killed them by the baskets full, you know, I mean, they were just, you know, there used to be this song, let the bodies hit the floor, and they played the song, you know, let the bodies hit the floor, let the bodies hit the floor. And then they started flashing up all the pictures of all these terrorists that were involved in the attacks on 9/11, and they got them all. You know, I mean, I don't know any of them that they missed. You know, so it's like, you know, that goal was accomplished. And then, of course, bin Laden, you know, when he was killed. I mean, you know, they killed that guy and then threw him out in the middle of the ocean. I mean, he's fish bait now. And it's like, it's done. You know, it's a done deal. So ultimately, I don't know where, you know, this, you know, and I had an argument with a news reporter. You're saying, well, we're supposed to be nation building. No, that's not what we do. We help you. We don't build your nation, and we don't build an empire. We're not an empire. We're not trying to put our flag up in all these different countries and say, you know, the sun never sets on the American empire.
Right.
You'll never hear that.
Right, like the Brits, yeah.
Like the British. And
I was going to say, we're not good at nations, because the problem is, we don't look at the problem and come up with a solution. We come up with a cookie cutter solution, and we try to recreate the American democracy wherever we go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listening to Biden's speech, you haven't listened to it, all right? And you've already admitted
that.
I point that out. Because what you just said, as far as what our mission was, is what Biden keeps saying. But he left something out, and so did you. And that is, see, we admitted that the reason that Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, because we helped the Mujahideen to defeat Russia and kick them out. And then we just forgot about Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
we didn't go in and, like, help them establish a government or whatever, you know, of their own making or whatever. So we abandoned it, and Afghanistan became a safe haven for al-Qaeda. And so what I remember everybody saying was an inherent, an implied mission with this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're going to go in and we're going to get, we're going to just
that's what the reporters
get the people
said too,
who attacked 9/11, who caused 9/11. They said, but we do not want to allow Afghanistan to be a safe haven for terrorism again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I kept hearing. And I'm not hearing that message anymore. They're ignoring it. And there's a problem. Now, what Biden has said is we're going to have, yes, we got, you know, what he did is to deflect that, that response. He says, well, we got terrorist activity in Africa and Syria and all these other places.
Right.
So we're looking at over-the-horizon capability, which is, again, CNN, ABC came back and going, okay, so you completely, your intelligence community that is telling you they'll be able to predict the next 9/11 is the same guys that did not predict this rapid fall of Afghanistan.
Wow.
Okay? They're like, you trust them for the future, and they either they failed you or you failed to listen to them.
Well, they forgot to add the ingredient of tribalism, okay? That was the big deal that no one played into it, that, you know, most of these Afghani troops that were in there, I mean, most of them were Pashtun, man. I mean, and that's your Taliban. They're Pashtun, you know, and they have this, this tribal obligation. And so, you know, when the time came, they either – they just took the uniform off or they just turned on the people. I mean, look, they've been turning on us for the longest time. So when I look at this as, you know, being a nation builder or being a training, yeah, we had a response. We, you know, we had the School of Americas at Fort Benning. Okay. I get it. We train people. We try to help them to self-govern. But at some point you just like our kids have got to eventually get out of the house and go to work, man. You know, they got to go get a job, go do something. I hate it. It breaks my heart when they leave. I love all my kids. But I'm so proud, and I'm kind of happy when they do leave, and they're successful. and you want to see. You know,
wait. How many kids do you have?
Eight.
Let's just put Lindsay on. How many kids?
Eight.
Is
I have eight.
Kids and all that? Yeah.
Yeah, I have eight kids, yeah. And then we have seven grandkids.
That's called a squad. James, that's called a squad.
Yeah, I got some strapping boys. I got five sons, and I'm telling you, the youngest one's 12. But, man, my adult sons, they will hurt you. They are strong, very strong young men, man. I'm telling you. They are – my one son came down from Wisconsin, and I'm telling you, they're good boys. And the beauty of it is that while two of them went to war – two of them, you know, three of them did not go. Obviously, my son that's 12, he couldn't go. But the two other boys, they didn't go. You know, they didn't enlist, and they decided to do their own thing. But neither one of them would have ran from it if they were asked to go, you know. They just, you know, it just wasn't their thing. And I think they saw their brothers, you know, come back and do that transition. And that's what I want to talk about is, okay, The political side of this, we don't have control of, you know. But I've got a friend on the line right now that, you know, him and I talk every day. We talk every day. How are we going to impact the veteran community and maximize our efforts? You know what I mean? So he was on the show a few weeks ago. He was the former national commander of the Purple Heart. He's now the past national commander of the Purple Heart, and he stayed on as the finance officer. And I've just been friends with this guy for a long time. And as you start to watch, you know, he's, you know, a lot of us, you know, I did the farming thing when I came back, but it wasn't just about me. It was about building something that would train other people. And now you see this massive, is it all me? No, there were other great, wonderful people that were doing this mission But, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that you know, I was able to contribute something to my fellow veterans, to, you know, to train up, you know, over 1,000, you know, veteran farmers in different aspects of agriculture. Whereas, you know, my friend that I'm going to bring on here, and we're going to talk about this, what are we going to do now that we don't have, you know, a constant barrage of money that's going to be going into warfare and contractors, and you know, that's where a lot of money was spent at, was on contractors. You know, are we going to divert? Are we going to redirect that money to help our veterans? And I think that we should. And Ernie Rivera is one of those guys that he works with dogs, man. I think you guys are going to really enjoy this part. Because you see a lot of people that are coming up with service dogs, and the service dog industry, you know, is like any other veteran, you know, nonprofit. It is filled with, you know, really good people and some really not so good people. And Ernie is one of those really good people that's provided over 200 service dogs free of charge to veterans and handicapped children. So I'd just like to bring him on the air now. Ernie Rivera, you are on the air, buddy. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
You know, it's like I just talked to you a few minutes ago.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, not too long ago.
So you're hearing all this stuff, but let's hear your thoughts on what we're talking about, man. Let's get your
thoughts. Yeah, so every Thursday at our facility, we have a every Thursday our facility is open. We have about 42 dogs here now and at different levels of training. You know, some of them are, you know, some are young, some are a couple month old puppies, some are, you know, a little bit older, and different levels of training. And every Thursday our facility is open for any veterans. We're in the Central Florida area, right outside of Orlando. So every Thursday we have what we call a Veterans Day at the facility, where veterans can just come. You don't have to have a dog. You don't have to know anything about dogs. We have a pretty decent group that come. Some people come and just hang out. We provide lunch for them, spend a few hours talking, seeing if they, you know, if there's anything we can do to help them, or if they just need to have a, you know, a place to go to hang out with other veterans. So it's all veterans that are there. Interesting, this yesterday, a veteran had popped in and was like, hey, and they said, hey, there's somebody here that wants to volunteer. So I said, yeah, come on in and you know, explain to him what was going on. At the very end of it, he came up before he was leaving. He was like, man, this is great. You know, I only live about 20 minutes away. I'd like to start coming here more. He's a recently medically retired member of the Army who did tours in Iraq and Afghanistan both. And he moved down here, and he's just trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do, you know, with my life? And you know, he's retired now, medically retired and disabled. And he said, I'm really interested in the dogs, but I don't know anything about it. And so that was, and I'd asked him, how did you hear about it? She goes, well, the Orlando VA. So what we do is any veterans in this area here that go to the Orlando VA, we let them all know. We've sent dogs to, we've got dogs in New York, we've got dogs in California, Texas, just all over the United States. And we get referrals from the VA, and we get them from all over. People see us on the line and stuff. And so after talking to him for a little while, and I explained to him, you know, hey, you know, you can come back and give him an application and everything. And so we have some dogs, and he looked at some of them, and it's like seeing the difference in when he walked in. And, you know, we all know that. We go into an area that we're not familiar with, and there's all these different people there. And then when he left, he was actually smiling. He was petting the dogs. And he was really interested. One of the things that, and this is something that's very concerning for me because I'm, you know, I'm heavily involved in the veterans community, and you see, you know, I know we have sent out numerous letters, and we've supported letters regarding Afghanistan, and a lot of the Afghanistan vets are upset right now, seeing it just kind of crumble. I somewhat felt that way when, because I served in Iraq, and I kind of felt that way some, seeing it just close down. Okay, we're done, and you sit back and you think of all your, you know, your fellow veterans who who were killed in action or wounded in action, or mm-hmm. they've come home and they've committed suicide and all these different things. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is important is that, and it's really amazing how all these different organizations, I mean, today we got emails from the Elizabeth Dole Foundation. I mean, all of them are reaching out. I know that a Lieutenant General Ired Livingston from the Wounded Warrior Project, he posted something on their website. And I think it's important listening to, I think it's the father, you're the one that was at Fort Bragg?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so listening to you saying you're worried about, are we going to forget about it? You know, and I think that what I've seen in the last, since this all has kicked off, I've seen a large group of many, many different veterans organizations. We even got an email to send out to our members from the White House regarding this, you know, the veteran helpline. And I do worry about that, because I can remember, you know, you don't hear a whole lot about the, you know, the whole thing. You know, hopefully we can continue to reach a handout to veterans that have experienced that. Because one of the things that's a little different in the military today, prior, is that it's volunteer. You know, so when you volunteer, and, you know, I think the retired colonel was talking about, well, you know, we're not sending our sons and daughters off. Well, no, we're not sending our sons and daughters off. We're volunteering to go. It's an all-volunteer force. So, you know, we're volunteering. It's a job. I mean, when I went, you know, I received, you know, it was a job. I mean, it was just like any other job. I mean, obviously my job was to go, and I was very proud of my job, because I would much rather fight the enemy overseas than fight him here, by far. I would much rather, because, you know, I have kids and grandkids, and I want to make sure they're safe, and I want to make sure that, you know, they can live free and safe. And I think it's that, you know, usually when something like this happens, everybody's like, oh, we need to worry about it. And then as time tapers off, you know, everybody goes to the next issue and stuff. And so, you know, me and James have talked about this. And one of the things that the good thing about the dogs and why I started doing the dogs was because I was severely injured. I spent about a year in the hospital, and I got a dog. And you know, there were some issues because it was stressful. It actually, my PTSD got worse. And so I told my wife, I said, look, this isn't helping. It's a lot more stress. So to a school, and I became a certified dog trainer. I took all these courses and stuff. And I started meeting all kinds of people that had service dogs. And they said, you know, at first it was exciting. It was nice. But then my dog wasn't really trained. My dog didn't really do anything. It was just kind of here. And so what we did when we started the organization is our number one priority is to provide highly trained service dogs that actually mitigate and do things to help the veterans and the kids. So the dogs, every dog that goes to our facility knows tasks. So the dogs, and we teach the handler and the dogs that if you're stressed out, you know, you can call the dog's name, the dog will look at you. You can touch your leg, the dog will touch you. You can tell the dog to lay, and the dog will lay up on your lap and do deep pressure therapy. And so it's been very successful to actually have the dogs that actually do something. You know, and we teach people, these are not pets. You know, this is actually a tool for you. This is like having something that can help you with your disability. So it's been very successful, and, you know, we've had a really, you know, all the dogs that we've sent out, you know, obviously there's one or two that, you know, there's been some issues, I think, that not with the dog as much as it's just been that the person it maybe wasn't really a dog person, but I've seen the impact, and I know the impact for myself, because once I got my dog trained, I mean, my dog has been with me. I've had a dog with me for 7 years. I mean, my dog's been to the White House. It's gone to Congress. My dog's been everywhere. And I personally know the impact that the dog can have. And I had a lot of issues. I mean, I couldn't even leave my house. And then having the dog to go with me. So you know, this is just something, it's just one small thing that that I try to do. Now, the key thing to this is it gives me as a veteran a mission again. So I have a mission.
Yes.
And I think that's a critical thing. Maybe it's a dog. Maybe it's fishing. Maybe it's farming. Maybe it's, you know, figuring out a business. Maybe it's a hobby. You know, it could be so many different things. Oh, yeah. I mean, and once you get a mission again, and that's what, you know, and I go around and talk to veterans all the time. I've given speeches and stuff. I tell them, I'm like, look, if you like dogs, you know, I'm your person to help you with the dog. But it's about having a mission. And one of the things that we have learned is that whenever you have a dog, the dog has to go to the bathroom. A lot of times veterans don't want to leave the house. You know, they start getting into that mode and they start getting very, you know, closed off to friends and family, and they don't want to go out. And, you know, they come and talk. It's like, well, I never leave my house. I don't want to leave and this and that. Well, if you don't take your dog outside, guess what? You're going to be cleaning up a lot of feces and urine off your carpet. So that's one way right there. Now they're going to get outside, breathe some fresh air, get a little bit of vitamin D, get a little sun on them, and start seeing other people because, you know, most people, unless you live out where you're not around anybody, you go to the VA, you're going to see people. And the cool thing about the dogs is it always, and everybody tells me this, and I know this, it engages, you know. People are like, hey, what's your dog's name? Oh, my dog's name is such and such. And before you know it, and I've seen this happen. I've seen this happen with many, many veterans. I see it happen almost every day where after a few months and then they get used to taking the dog with them, it's like I see a huge impact where it gives them something to do again. It gives them a mission. And we have veterans from newly just came out of the military to veterans who served in you know, the first part of Vietnam. So a very, very large range. You know, we're not one of those organizations that's like, well, it's got to be this war or not, because I despise that. I dislike that when organizations pit one group of veterans against another, because it's really not the right thing to do.
Right.
And I've seen the difference. And I think that this is just one small part of it. I mean, we do it. We've got a really good system, and we've seen the impact it makes. And I think it's important. Right now is an important time, because I can tell you since this stuff is happening in Afghanistan, we've probably seen about a 50% increase in requests for people to get an application and to get a dog and to just come to the facility and talk and stuff. And we're just trying to do our little part, just provide them with the mission, you know.
That's excellent.
Hey, can I ask a question?
Go ahead, yeah. The first thing I'd like to ask is, Ernie, give us your website address real quick.
It's www.vmsd.org.
Gotcha.
Vmsd.org. It's and it stands for Valor Medical Service Dogs.org. That's the name of the organization, Valor Medical Service Dogs. We're in Florida. We're in Central Florida. It's a town. It's called Tulioda. It's about probably 15 minutes the east side of Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead, Rich. You had a question.
All right. Yeah, all right. Now, when I'm familiar with therapy dogs. I've seen them. They're all, you know, like medium-sized dogs. They got their little vest on. And you know, I'm a cat lover, okay? I had the last cat I had, man, it wouldn't jump up until I had to pat my cat. It would sit there and look at me, and I'm like, you know, cats see people as furniture. So I sit there and, like, pat my chest. Boom, that cat, I'm laying on the sofa. It jumps up on it, curls into a ball on my chest, starts purring, knocks me out, man. That's the best sedative there was, man. there's nothing could like cause me to like black out. Is that little cat purring on my chest? Okay. Now, but most therapist dogs I'm dealing with, I've seen, are all like medium, big-sized dogs. So I did a lot of work with the Vietnam vets, the gun truck vets. I'm a plank holder. I helped form the gathering, okay? And so I got to become friends with a lot of these veterans. And there's this one guy who... he was very well adjusted when it came to his experience because, you know, he's like, I volunteered for Airborne, but he had flat feet, so he ended up as a truck driver. So, you know, he could talk about the ambushes. He got on gun truck because he already had training in guns, machine guns and stuff like that. And so they're like, because he'd originally signed up as infantry. So then... all right, I show up at this reunion. He's got this little bitty dog, the kind you fit in the palm of your hand. And I'm asking about it. He goes, no, this is my therapy dog. So I'm like, first of all, I didn't think he had any problem because he kept telling me, nah, I handle it. But it's like, no, this is he's got a therapy dog. And I'm sitting here going like, okay, I get it. You know, a cat could be great therapy for me. But I'm sitting there going like, all I saw was everybody wanting to come and pet his dog. I'm like, was the therapy the attention he was getting from the dog everybody wanted to play with? Or was it having the old dog lick him in the face? Tell me. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a tiny therapy dog.
Well, you know, I've actually done dogs before, small dogs. I mean, I've actually done, you know, very, like, Shih Tzu dogs. I've done mm-hmm. all sizes of dogs. And a lot of it, and, you know, and a lot of people ask me this. They're like, because we get, you know, I talk to people almost every day about dogs. And I always ask them, because we have a pretty large selection of dogs, different sizes, different ages and stuff. And some are ready to go. Some we let the person... you know, if they're really in a – we do it a little different because I don't have a waiting list. We triage people. So somebody comes in and they're having a difficult time. We spend time with them. And, you know, we have requirements. They got to fill out applications, turn in all the paperwork, and get a note from their doctor and stuff. And so what I always tell them is it's got to be where the attraction that you have to the dog. Like in your case, you like cats, right? So you see a cat. I'm sure that if you were somewhere and you saw a cat and it was purring, and you would probably go up and pet it. Well, there are some people that have that same kind of attraction and that likeness to a dog. And so some people like big dogs, small dogs, in-between dogs, all different dogs. The unique thing about dogs is if they're trained properly, it doesn't matter. At our facility, the way we pay for the dogs is we actually – I have a company that we train pet dogs. So we have dogs at our facility all the time that are other people's dogs, and we bring the dogs in and we train a pet dog with the same basic obedience foundation, and then the people pay it, and we volunteer our time. We use that money to pay for the dogs because the dogs cost us about $6,000 a dog, start to finish, completely done at $6,000 because nobody pays.
Wow.
Nobody pays. No veteran or kid pays a dime. They don't pay. And so we make sure that, you know, it's everything's covered for them. Once they get the dog, then obviously they need to pay for its food and, you know, the vet and stuff like that because, you know, it's just too hard for us. We've gotten up to a number of them that, you know, it's just so many of them. And you got to have a special relationship. You got to make sure that the person's willing to, you know, have the, you know, the ability to care for the dog enough that they're willing to make that little bit of a sacrifice. It's not that much money. One of the things that I notice is people are attracted to different kinds of dogs, and we train every single dog. Now, one of the critical things to being a successful dog trainer is to learn about all the breeds of dogs and to learn how each one of them, their behavior is different and how they react to certain things. There are certain dogs that you can't punish. Because if you punish them, they'll shut down. And what I mean by punishing them is you put a leash on them and a collar, you're punishing a dog because you're taking away its social freedom. So to a dog, that's punishment. And we don't advocate for any type of hitting, hurting. We don't use metal prong collars or anything like that. So the thing is that no matter what the breed of the dog is, it could be a Chihuahua, We could. There's times we have Chihuahuas and we have Rottweilers or Dobermans and German Shepherds all together, because there's. It isn't about me as an individual. You know, my job is just to say, okay, you bring me your dog, and I'm going to train that dog, because every single dog is the same way. It's you know, a few different dogs have some different attitudes and stuff, but you have to adjust the training. But for the most part, they're all basically the same. They're all basically the same. So no matter what it is, all the basic foundation of obedience is done the same. We train a – right now at our facility, we have a seven-month-old XL bully, which is a pit bull, massive pit bull that's about over 100 pounds and he's 7 months old. We also have a small little dog that is a and that dog is actually going to be training. I'm actually training that dog to be a service dog for a young man in this area who has Lyme disease and is really sick. And so this dog, and he gets really tired. So sometimes he gets tired and he gets real fatigued. So we're training this dog brace for him. So this dog will be able to go with him. He starts getting tired. He'll be able to lean on the dog. The dog will be able to do that. So obviously he can't have a small dog. He has to have a very strong dog. And we do a full temperament test and we evaluate him around other dogs and many people and all that before we even let them get into the program. They have to. That's a minimal. And so
all right, I got another question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Because this is fascinating. All right. Who needs a dog? And I say that is it's a legitimate question because the problem that I deal with, another number of people deal with, is being an adrenaline junkie. Okay. For me, what I needed is something that provided that same stimulus, all right? So now I'd been a martial artist, a boxer, and whatever, did Taekwondo before I got my commission, and I found that is my release. There's a lot of therapy in punching the bag. And I'm now in Aikido. I've been doing Aikido for 25 years, and there's a real focus I get out of this. And I've seen other people, you know, there was a documentary on a platoon or company that went to Afghanistan and occupied an outpost. And when they covered these guys, when they came back, and one of the guys found BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, as his therapy. You know, as soon as I could see him, he's going there and he's like, oh, God, I know exactly what he's talking about. Because when you get on the mat rolling, whatever you're thinking about during the day is gone because you have total focus. So what kind of people need a dog? And, you know, for me, I'm thinking for people who have, you know, you want some kind of release. You know, martial arts is a solution. It gives you a focus. If you're addicted to adrenaline, which there's guys who are who keep volunteering.
Well, there is, and so we have people that, so we do all different types of dogs. Like, so my dog in particular is he's a world class German Shepherd. His ancestor comes from like canine biting. Top of the line working dog. I can tell you, I could take a tennis ball. I could take him for walks, and he could go anywhere. He's flown tens of thousands of miles with me all over the United States. And I'll tell you, he is what it does for me personally. And James could tell you this too, because I go to meetings sometimes. There's 100 people in the meeting, and I'm there doing the meeting and stuff. And if I get down and walk, right. He'll come down right there and walk with me everywhere I go. And so one of the things it helps me to do is it's like I have my battle buddy with me all the time. He's with me all the time, 24/7. He's laying here right now by my feet. So what that does for me, and it does for a lot of veterans, is to have that sense of it's not really security because they're not trained to bite or anything like that. But to always have the ability to have dogs give unconditional love, right?
That's
one of the
I
things that
say.
Happens.
I was already
yes.
thinking that when you're talking
love.
Unconditional love. Yes.
You got it. No matter what. And I'll tell you, it's like a lot of times what you'll see is, and we get this because we have them fill out forms and stuff. If a veteran gets upset and they start getting upset, and let's say they're starting to engage with their spouse. Let's say they're having an argument with a friend or a family member or whatever. The dog senses that, and then the dog starts acting different. And if anyone who's ever had a dog before, the only time you notice your dog is when it starts acting different. So now the dog starts acting different. The dog will come and engage you. Hey, what's going on? You know, this isn't what I'm used to, especially if the dog's with you all the time. There's been many times that I've, you know, started to get into a heated conversation and my dog just like bumps against me and is like staring at me. I look down at him and it's almost like it grounds me. It's like, oh, you know, I got to go to the bathroom. Okay. So I take the dog out to go to the bathroom or whatever the case may be. And so where it's really, really that I've seen the most help is when a lot of times veterans that are suffering from real severe PTSD, they don't want to leave their house ever. They will order food in. They'll order, you know, especially with COVID happening. You know, a lot of them, you know, they didn't want to go to the store.
I'm going to tell you one of the common symptoms of PTSD is avoiding crowds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people suffering PTSD do not like crowds. They want to avoid. Yeah,
before I got my dog,
contact,
yes.
But they just don't. Would it
be
crowded
yep.
in? Yeah.
Nope, not at all. But now, in my case, I've got an 85-pound German Shepherd. I don't care about a crowd because I can tell you what, I've been all over the place. I one time, and this is a funny story. I was going to a meeting at the Eisenhower Building next to the White House. And of course, if you ever been to Washington, you know there's always people protesting out there and all that. And I went walking through there, and I'll tell you what, I don't like crowds like that either. But with that dog and me walking, and I was wearing my suit and tie and all that, boy, I'll tell you what, I didn't have to worry about people coming near me. It, like, parted the seas. I'll tell you, the Secret Service guys were at the fence laughing about it. It's like people just got right out of the way. Now, that's not the intent of it, because I was, you know, thinking, I think I was and I noticed they were laughing, and then I looked up, and it was like people were just moving out of the way. Now, that wasn't the intent of the dog, but that just happened. It kind of made me chuckle a little bit, like, you know, wow. I mean, I wasn't paying attention to it, but it made me feel good in a sense, not because, you know, it was like a dog sense in people. Like, I always tell my clients, if your dog barks at a person, and no matter what you get, you say to your dog or whatever, your dog will not stop doing it, don't become friends with that person. Because dogs have a very unique way of sensing, you know, bad in people. They really do.
Now I'm offended because most dogs like me. But when I run in the neighborhood, there's this little bitty dog that barks at me all the time. And I'm nice to the owners, but that little dog barks at me all the time. So you tell me I'm an evil person?
No. What I'm saying is that if it's a little dog barking at you, I'll tell you, imagine this. Imagine if, and most little dogs bark. So dogs don't bark for, and I'm not talking about a dog barking like that. I'm talking about a dog like trying to like get you. I'm talking about like ferociously barking. I'm not talking like rah, 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 little. So what dog?
I know. I'm just joking.
You know,
little
so,
dogs.
Well, when
little
dogs
dog,
bark,
they have to bark.
Little
like
dogs bark all the time. Oh, they do. Right. They do. I've got this one little one that we're training for a rescue. I'll tell you this. This nicest lady brought her dog by today. She's a really she comes here all the time. They donated their time and a bunch of stuff at the facility, and she brought her dog to visit. And, boy, this little dog that we trained, sweet little dog, man, it would not stop barking at her. And it wasn't because it wanted to bite her or anything. It was because it was like a strange person. I don't know you. And I'm in a crate, so now I'm locked down. And it just, you know, and the dog has never done that before. And so then I let the dog out. The dog was fine. It went up. Hey, it was really nice to her. But it was like, dogs bark for two reasons. One is they bark as an alert, like, okay, look, I'm alerting, I'm alerting, I'm alerting. That's how the wolves became, you know, they morphed over into the domesticated side because we, you know, humans, we utilize them as an alert system because it's like, hey, the dog's barking, I can hear it, there might be a predator coming to get it. The other thing is dogs bark to give a sign to social distancing. So in social distancing for a dog, that's why they bark at each other, and you'll watch them. They might growl or bark, and then the dog will walk away because the other dog's saying, oh, okay, you don't want me to go near you. And so then the dog's going to walk away. Part about it with a veteran, and I see this every day. I mean, every day I see this with the veterans because we almost every day we have veterans come out here. And one of
Ernie,
the things
can
that I
– ask a question?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Father Mike, I want to ask a question. You know, when you have that kind of codependence and that kind of camaraderie, what happens when someone loses a dog, maybe by an accident or just by death? How do you deal with that?
Well,
are they able to bond with anybody else?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because so most people, it's funny you brought that up because I had a lady that brought a dog to me today. She just rescued this dog. It didn't get along with her other dog. She was really nervous. And I'd asked her, I said, well, when did your other dog pass away? And she goes, oh, well, 2 weeks ago. I just could not imagine myself without a dog.
Mm.
So it's very unique because what happens is we all know that dogs' lives, you know, the average person has about six dogs. So we know that, you know, that it, in our entire lives, we know their lifespan is shorter than ours. One of the things that we try to do with the dogs is we try to make sure that they're younger. We try, check them to make sure they're healthy, you know, and we always prioritize. So if somebody has a dog that is getting older, what we do is we start working with them to train another dog. So that what happens is the other dog comes into the picture, then it kind of trains and is around the other dog, and then we start preparing them so that, hey, you know, your dog can retire. And then what happens is when the one dog retires, it might just stay at home and hang out. They still keep the dog. Now the other dog is the dog that starts going out with them more and starts being around them more. And then that way it lightens the person's now it's not like, okay, all of a sudden one day I have a dog, my service dog that's with me all the time, and it passes away. We've experienced that. I personally experienced that. And it's tough. It really, it's a tough thing. And, and what I did the same thing. My dog was accidentally killed, and I already had a dog that was eventually going to replace that dog, and I just immediately started working with him. And that's my dog now, my second service dog. He's been with me every day since the day that my other dog passed away. So he's with me all the time. And so, yeah, it just boom, boom, comes right in. And just, and that's what we do. The other thing that we do that's a little different is, and this stuff has happened, we actually had a one of our veterans that actually took his own life. And we allowed the girlfriend to keep the dog because the dog witnessed it happen. And so she was distraught. We helped them through the whole process, her and the dog, and then she actually got the dog. You know, witnessing something like that, people have PTSD from it. So obviously she, you know, qualified for a dog. But we never, ever, when we sign the contract, we do not ever take the dog away from the family. Because we've had incidents where, you know, the service member or the person, the veteran, has passed away. And then the last thing you want to do is call them up and say, hey, by the way, yeah, we want the dog back. So for the next couple years, we can, or the rest of its life, we're going to give it to somebody else. We don't do that. There's some organizations that do. We don't. I would never do that to a family. You know, you have a family that's bonded with a dog. Now the veteran passes away. And it's like, oh, give me the dog back. I would never do that.
No.
Never.
Yeah, that's great.
Yep. We sure don't.
Well, gentlemen, we are unfortunately almost down to time. We're down to 4 minutes and 40 seconds. You know, the whole gist of this thing and what Ernie is saying is that, you know, we are, you know, we're standing ready, you know, for this massive influx of people. And the, you know, the canine piece of this, you know, a service dog is one part of it. I would encourage everyone to go to his website at www.V as in Victor, M as in Mike, S as in Sierra, D as in Delta, .org. That's www.vmsd.org or just vmsd.org. And look up information and find out what he's doing. You know, there is a are a lot of people that are in this, you know, for all the right reasons. And like I said, you know, we've run into organizations that are not in it for the right reasons. And fortunately, Ernie is a guy that's very selfless and has a lot of humility and he's humble. So, you know, some things about, you know, Ernie was our former national commander, the Military Order of the Purple Heart. You know, we had some things that were going on in there, required a tremendous amount of work and effort. So I know I've worked with him directly and been friends with him for over 3 years now, and I can tell you it has been one heck of a roller coaster ride, but we finally got this thing leveled out, and I feel really confident going forward. So if you're out there, folks, and you're listening to this radio show, I've seen a lot of interest in the dogs. So, Ernie, we're going to have to bring you back on because I'm telling you, I've got people that are texting me. I've got people that are sending me Facebook messages. So I need to forward some of those over to you because people are really interested in what you're doing. And I'm sure folks that Ernie will return your calls and emails just as soon as he gets them. But he does this on his own, you know. And we haven't even got into the stories of success that have occurred from some of these service dogs. We don't have time for it today because we only got 2 minutes left now as we're closing it out. But I do want to bring him back on so he can tell you about some of these kids, especially some of these kids of veterans, some of them that were, some of the veterans that had been wounded themselves and had, different issues themselves. You know, their kids were ill, they were sick, they needed help, and Ernie has provided a dog through his organization to them free of charge, and that's about a $6,000 dog there. So, Rich Kilblaine, I would urge you to call him and maybe instead of getting a service cat, maybe you get a service dog.
No. I'm not. We had a little dog. We had a little French bulldog or whatever. It was eating everything.
I know. Well,
it was eating
you got to get one that's trained, old buddy.
Eating the furniture. It was eating the trim. I like a cat. All you got to do is just give it a place to crap. Okay, you don't have to train the cat.
I know. Well. So anyway, when you're ready to join the man's club, give us a call.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, folks, we've got 1 minute left. Ernie Rivera, Father Michael Pacella, Rich Kilblaine, thank you all three very much for coming on the show. All of you guests that listen to us every Friday, you're such a wonderful, wonderful part of what we do. And we're thankful that we have this opportunity to come to you. So on behalf of Continue Mission, I want to wish each and every one of you a wonderful and glorious good night and good weekend and say to you and your family, look, if you haven't had a chance to be nice to somebody, wake up in the morning and do your best to do something positive every day. God bless you, folks, and have a wonderful and blessed night. Good night, everyone. Good night, gentlemen.